This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
As some say the two doses are fine, while others say they felt the side effect, therefore they don't want to go through the same experience.
That's Mogmotsi Matshaba, scientific advisor for Botswana's COVID-19 task force on resistance to getting booster shots for COVID-19 vaccines. Details coming up. Also, senior Sudanese officials who served in the country's former ruling sovereign council have been arrested in Khartoum. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, has warned South Africa to solve its energy crisis or risk losing loans in the future. The country suffered frequent electricity outages for the past 15 years, which the IMF says are steadily eroding Africa's second largest economy. South Africa's state energy corporation, Eskom, is almost bankrupt, chiefly as a result of corruption that happened when Jacob Zuma was president from 2009 until 2018, but also because some of its biggest clients are not paying for the electricity they are consuming. Darren Taylor reports.
Eskom's last financial report, released late last year, reflects a gross debt of more than 400 billion rands. That's about $27 billion. It owes the money partly because cities and towns, especially those managed by the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, aren't paying their electricity bills.
The city's bill with Eskom is 635 million rand. The city does pay.
Jordan Griffiths is chief of staff in the mayor's office in Tshwane, the administrative capital of South Africa.
As with the capital city, we have a lot of national departments based around the city of Tshwane, which owe us tens of millions. Places like the Department of Public Works, the military, which owes the city over 200 million rand. They also include, for instance, the Department of Health and even Provincial Education Department as well, which is very difficult to manage because we can't cut off the power to hospitals or to schools.
Williams says the departments seem to think they're entitled to free electricity simply because they're affiliated to the ANC government. He represents a city council run by the Opposition Democratic Alliance, the DA. ANC regional chair Khosi Mayepa says it's the DA's fault that the city has such a large electricity debt.
The DA has failed in its fiduciary duties to manage our finances of the city of Tshwane. That has nothing to do with the African National Congress. The DA has mismanaged the money. Now, after mismanaging the money, it blames departments, national departments.
Williams responds that when the DA took the city over about a year ago, the ousted ANC left it with a debt of 4 billion rands. But while the political parties argue, Eskom sinks further into the red. Still, the government gives the company regular cash injections to try to save it. Energy experts say it's a pointless exercise, since Eskom's coal-fired power stations are mostly beyond repair and almost obsolete. The future, they say, lies in green energy generated by independent power producers, IPPs. The state, however, seems unwilling to even downscale an Eskom which for decades has been one of its major cash cows. Instead, it's hiking electricity prices massively, forcing citizens to keep the company on life support. Ruse Moleshe manages an IPP.
Reliance of South Africans on Eskom as an entity is becoming untenable. South Africa has to look at the private sector.
The only sensible way forward, says Moleshe, is for Eskom and the IPPs to share the responsibility of providing electricity to South Africa. In the near future, she says, Eskom's going to split into three divisions to make it much more efficient.
Eskom has already done the staff separation, has done most of the internal divisional separation. Also, they've been going to the market looking for board members to serve within that entity. So it is on the cards, and I think it will happen.
The IMF says Eskom's business model is outdated and it needs to plot a new way forward. The government says it's already following that advice. But, say analysts, it has to tread carefully, as South Africa's powerful labour movement says if the state privatises Eskom, it'll withdraw its support for the ANC, which could cost the party millions of votes come the next election in 2024. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A former senior Sudanese government official and two of his subordinates have again been arrested in Khartoum, the latest in a series of former officials and activists to be detained in recent months. Sudan's Unionist Alliance Party identified him as Mohamed Al-Faqih Suleiman. He served in the country's former ruling Sovereign Council as deputy head for a government-run agency tasked with dismantling the legacy of former autocratic president Omar al-Bashir. Yesterday, according to the Associated Press, Suleiman and two of his subordinates were taken to the Soba prison in Khartoum. Last week, Khalid Omar, a minister in the ousted transitional government, and Walid Saleh, another committee member, were arrested. Sudan has been politically paralyzed since a coup late last year. Detentions have intensified in recent weeks as the country plunges into further turmoil with nearly daily street protests. Protest groups have called for demonstrations today in Khartoum and elsewhere in the country, demanding the establishment of a fully civilian government to lead the transition to democracy. As more and more discussions center on development finance to reduce energy poverty, a new study from the Center for Global Development highlights the fact that Americans and UK citizens, on average, emit vastly more amounts of CO2 than the average person living in sub-Saharan Africa. On the first day of the year, the average American had already emitted more CO2 than the average citizen in the Democratic Republic of Congo will all year. The author of the study, Iwan Richi, spoke to Ricky Shryock about what these inequalities mean.
We all know that there is a big disparity in energy use and CO2 emissions between these regions, but I wanted to kind of highlight just how big that disparity is. And actually, I was even quite surprised calculating, doing the number crunching and finding that, you know, it's orders of magnitude more energy use in the UK or the US, which means that just a few days of living in the UK or the US, the average person will use more energy than someone from sub-Saharan Africa is likely to in the entire year.
And what does this mean in terms of when we talk about green financing, financing for carbon emissions, financing for fossil fuels, et cetera, things like that? How should the conversation shift given this information?
So I think there are two main conclusions that I would take from this. One is that taking a hard line against funding for fossil fuel projects in Africa doesn't make sense and is likely to prolong energy poverty on the continent longer than is necessary. So there's nearly 600 million people who don't have any access to electricity on the continent. And it's widely understood that due to technological issues with trying to power the grid using 100% renewables, that's not going to change unless there's still a role for fossil fuels, particularly natural gas, in addressing the energy poverty. And the second is that basically nothing really that African countries do is going to have a big impact on global emissions. Even if sub-Saharan Africa doubled its electricity consumption overnight, and that was all powered using natural gas, it would still add less than 1% to global emissions. And therefore, basically, it's much more important that the rich countries try and tackle their own fossil fuel use, stop using fossil fuel subsidies to encourage more use of fossil fuels, and also stop expanding their own fossil fuel infrastructure. For example, the UK has currently just approved an expansion of a coal mine in Wales, which will produce 40 million more tons of coal. And the US has been pushing for lower for extra oil production to bring down energy prices in the US. Stopping that is much more important than restricting funding for some fossil fuel projects in Africa.
What about, some of these deals that involve, debt forgiveness for agreeing to lower emissions and things like that? Do you think that's a bit of a hypocritical stance for some financial institutions, or given the fact that if we're talking about emissions as a form of currency, everyone else is in debt to sub-Saharan Africa, actually?
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. So one thing that I didn't go into in the analysis, but colleagues at CGD have looked at is the fact that in terms of cumulative emissions, so the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, the vast majority of that has come from richer countries, and therefore it doesn't make sense to try and use that as leverage over African countries, especially as lots of this debt goes back a long time and it's been accumulating with penalty and interest charges and so on.
That was Ioan Ritchie, author of a recent study on CO2 emissions. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from the United Kingdom. The United Nations in Nigeria says more than $1 billion is needed to help millions of people in the country's troubled northeast. The UN says a million of those people are living in areas that are cut off due to insecurity. Nigeria has been closing northeastern camps for internally displaced people and urging them to return home despite ongoing threats from Islamist militants. Timothy Obiezu reports from the capital, Abuja.
The launch of the UN's 2022 Humanitarian Response Plan for Nigeria was held in Abuja Wednesday. UN Nigeria Humanitarian Coordinator Matthias Shimali said $1.1 billion is needed to reach some 5.5 million people who are in need of aid in the northeast this year. The UN official said over 2.2 million people remain displaced due to recurring attacks in the region and that 1 million are in areas designated as, quote, hard to reach, end quote, or inaccessible to aid workers.
By definition, we are not close to those people. That's what hard to reach means. So we are ringing the alarm bell over the million people. Our estimate is that out of the million people in hard to reach areas, 700,000 are in acute need. And we will try and do our best to expand, but it's really linked to security and access.
Those areas are still largely controlled by armed militant groups, including Boko Haram, who have been waging a war in the northeastern states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe for 12 years. The UN says hundreds of thousands of people, including women and children, have been killed and millions reduced to deplorable living standards. Officials said the coronavirus pandemic and rising prices for food have further exacerbated conditions for millions of vulnerable people. Trond Jensen, who heads Nigerian operations for the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says the new response plan will target the most vulnerable people first.
The plan is the result of the unwavering commitment by all of those involved to ensure that life-saving assistance gets to where it's needed most, and also to protect the most vulnerable people.
Since late last year, Nigerian authorities have been urging displaced people to return home and closing camps under the caveat of improved security despite threats of attacks by Boko Haram. In December, Amnesty International said at least 6 people were killed and 14 others injured during attacks at resettlement camps. But authorities also cited the need for residents to return to their farms in order to avert famine and reduce dependence on outside aid. The United States Ambassador to Nigeria, Mary Beth Leonard, says plans are underway to evaluate high-risk areas and provide support before resettling displaced people.
We're so eager to partner with the state authorities so that we can make sure we've got collaborative, consultative, principled decisions about where it is appropriate for people to go, when we can get them there, how we can support them.
Last year, the United Nations assisted nearly 5 million people in Nigeria, including 1.3 million who needed nutritional support. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Botswana health officials say the uptake of COVID-19 booster dose has been slow. The Southern African country has nearly 3 million doses in stock, but only 63,000 have been administered since December. From Abrone, reporter Bokandisi Dube has the details.
COVID-19 Task Force Scientific Advisor Mhomozi Masaba says there's been little interest in the booster shots. In the Task Force weekly address Thursday, Masaba urged the public to go for the additional COVID-19 protection.
We are at 1,376,754. That is the number of those who got the first dose. Fully vaccinated, 1,124,733. Take this opportunity to encourage people to go in large numbers to get their boosters to boost their immune system.
Masaba says adverse effects suffered by a few after inoculation could be causing the slow response.
There are a number of reasons why people are reluctant to get their booster dose. Some say the two doses are fine, while others say they felt the side effects. Therefore, they don't want to go through the same experience.
Last week, the country's medicines regulator, the Botswana Medicine Regulatory Authority, indicated it was following developments over reports that inoculation had led to hepatitis reaction in Europe. Such reports, says Haburon resident Mpo Mokoena, are unsettling.
Yes, we are keen, but at the same time afraid to go for the booster doses. Some people feel the two doses they got is enough. Also, reports of people getting a reaction to the vaccine also do not help.
Meanwhile, Matsaba says authorities are concerned that the slow response could see vaccines expire before use.
We have concerns. The whole batch might be expired since they were manufactured at the same time. People should know that this is their money, the taxpayers' money. If the vaccines expire, it's the public funds that are wasted.
Botswana received the bulk of its vaccine consignments in December, with more than 2 million doses delivered. At least 73% of the country's adult population is fully vaccinated. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haboroni, Botswana.
Cameroon has held birthday celebrations across the country for President Paul Biya, who turned 89 years old on Sunday. Supporters wished Biya, who is Africa's oldest and second longest-serving leader, a long life, while opponents say it's well past time for him to leave office. Bonki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
This birthday song blasts through speakers Sunday at the multi-purpose sports complex in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. The country's Minister of Youth Affairs and Civic Education says more than 2,500 young people turned out to celebrate Cameroon President Paul Biya's 89th birthday at the sports complex. Cameroon's National Youth Council said it organized the birthday celebration in collaboration with the government of Cameroon. 27-year-old teacher Patrice Gifo is a spokesperson for the National Youth Council. Gifo says Biya has dedicated his entire life as a true servant of all Cameroonians and their country. He says young people are celebrating Biya for spending his time in office to democratize Cameroon and keep the country united and prosperous. Biya was not physically present at his Yaoundé birthday celebration. His representative, Ferdinand Gongo, Secretary General of Cameroon's presidency, said Biya is delighted that young Cameroonians love the president. Gongo said Biya is a patriot and will do everything possible to make Cameroon a better place to live in.
Son Excellence Paul Biya, notre president.
Gongo says other nations envy Cameroon because of Biya's exceptional leadership qualities. He says Biya is calm, discreet, and always listens to his people before making decisions. Similar activities were held in towns and villages throughout Cameroon. The government said young people came out voluntarily to celebrate Biya's birthday, but critics say they were paid $5 each to take part in the birthday event. During past election campaigns, critics also say Biya has used money to buy people's votes. Biya became president in 1982. He took over from Cameroon's first president, Ahmadou Ahidjo. Biya had served as prime minister since 1975. He has won all multi-party elections since 1992, and the opposition has always complained of heavy election rigging by Biya. In 2008, Biya abolished the constitution's two-term limit. Denis Kemlemo is a spokesperson for the opposition Social Democratic Front. He says Biya should leave power if he loves his people. Kemlemo questions Biya's ability to lead as he is getting older.
It beats everybody's imagination. 40 years, somebody is president and nobody around him think that they can be a Cameroonian to take the relay baton. This is somebody who is very old, who has not been able to physically attend many occasions that demands his presence because of his age and tiredness and all the other physical disabilities that go with age.
The government has always said Biya is in excellent health. The last time Biya was seen in public was when he presided over an Africa Cup of Nations final game between Senegal and Egypt at Yaoundé's 60,000-seat Olembe Stadium. He spent close to 4 hours for the match and the closing ceremony of Africa's top football event. The 89-year-old Biya is Africa's oldest president. He is the second longest-serving leader in Africa after his neighbor Teodoro Obiang Nguema of Equatorial Guinea. Obiang has been in power since 1979. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Uhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baru, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.